VOA 1, The Hits!
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
All the paintings and other works of art you find at museums around the world represent just a small percentage of their collections. Most of what they have is, at any given time, stored away out of the public eye. One art museum in the Netherlands is trying to change that. Charles X is director of Museum Boijmans van Beuningen in Rotterdam. Recently, he showed the museum's new depot, or storage area, to the Associated Press and other media. The building is expected to hold 151,000 artworks when it opens to the public next year. Almost all these works have yet to be made available and shown to the public at any given time. X told reporters, "You mount about 6% of the collection, but then you have 90% in storage. What is the public responsibility to not show 90%? He added that having so much of a collection in storage means that it can be forgotten. When you cannot look at it, you always have the kind of risk that it's out of sight, out of mind," he said. The project was partly driven by a problem. The old storage space in the basement of the museum was in danger of flooding. That could put the valuable artwork at risk. The new depot is near the center of Rotterdam's Museum Park. The 39.5-meter-tall depot is covered with 1,664 shiny mirrors. The mirrors have special meaning to Rotterdam residents. Local people and organizations paid for many of them at a cost of about $1,165 each. Their donations helped to pay for the $105 million project. The top of the building is the new home for 75 birch trees. The trees were grown at ground level so that their roots could interconnect to make them stronger. Inside the new depot, visitors will find 5 different climates, each one designed to protect different kinds of art. Materials such as glass, prints, and paintings by the famous Dutch masters will be kept in areas meant for them. Architect Winnie Moss designed the depot. He said museum officials did not want a depot that looked like a high-security building on the edge of the city. Instead, it is in the middle of green open space and surrounded by other museums in the center of the city. Moss designed the building to be round and wider on top than on the bottom. He said he wanted to reduce the space it takes up. The depot, however, will be a working environment. The inside is very simple. Visitors may see workers preparing artworks for shipping and conservators working to repair old paintings. The depot will also have space for members of the public who want to store their art. The openness of the depot seems to be a security worry, but X said the art is safe. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
The American Library Association released its list of the 100 books that have been censored the most in the United States. The ALA calls it the list of most challenged books. The list includes books from writers Toni Morrison, a Nobel Prize winner, John Green, Harper Lee, and Margaret Atwood. Parents' criticisms of these books included descriptions of illegal drug use and suicide. Offensive language was also one of the reasons. A lot of the books on the list show that parents are questioning books by people of color and books from the LGBTQ community, said Deborah Caldwell Stone. She is the director of the Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom. Examples include Morrison's The Bluest Eye, about a black girl raped by her father, Alex Gino's George, about a transgender child, and Justin Richardson's and Peter Parnell's picture book about two gay penguins, and Tango Makes Three. The list was announced this week as the Library Association prepares for its yearly Banned Books Week. The ALA explains that an attempt to censor a book is a written complaint filed with a library or school requesting that materials be removed because of content or appropriateness. The list over the past 10 years includes popular books such as Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird and Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Others included were Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, John Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, and J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye. I'm Susan Shand.
The Sixth Sense is a famous American movie. The 1999 film tells the story of a young boy who has an unusual issue. He claims that he can see dead people. In the film, the boy describes his problem.
I see dead people walking around like regular people. They don't see each other. They only see what they want to see.
Today on Everyday Grammar, we will explore some of the words that you just heard. We will also explain a pronoun that the boy used, the words each other. This term is an example of a reciprocal pronoun. But first, Let's start with a few definitions. Pronouns are words that take the place of a noun. Words such as I, me, or my are personal pronouns. The word you choose depends on how it is used in a sentence. For example, personal pronouns can act as the subject or object. They can also show possession. This is known as the possessive case. When using the first person, the subject pronoun is I, and the object pronoun is me. The possessive pronoun is my. Some grammar books use the term possessive adjective in place of the term possessive pronoun. What exactly are reciprocal pronouns? Reciprocal is a word that describes a relationship in which people or groups do something similar, as in this sentence.
Mark helped Bob, and Bob helped Mark.
In newspapers, you might read about reciprocal trade agreements. Consider an imaginary trade deal between two countries. Country A reduces taxes on goods from Country B, and in return, Country B lowers taxes on goods from Country A. In grammar, reciprocal pronouns are pronouns that refer to a previously named noun. They suggest that one person or group does something to or for another person or group. In exchange, that person or group does something to or for the first person or group. Luckily, there are only two reciprocal pronouns you need to know. They are each other and one another. Consider our earlier example.
Mark helped Bob, and Bob helped Mark.
With a reciprocal pronoun, the sentence would become,
Mark and Bob helped each other.
The pronoun each other refers to two people, Mark and Bob. Reciprocal pronouns have two common uses. First, they can act as objects referring to previously named nouns, as in our example about Mark and Bob. Second, they can act as determiners, words that mark nouns in the possessive case. Here is an example.
Mark and Bob even do each other's homework.
Now, you might be wondering about the second reciprocal pronoun, one another. How is it different from each other? In general, each other refers to two nouns, while one another refers to three or more nouns. Here is an example.
All the players on the team help one another with their homework.
Knowing the difference between each other and one another is important for a very strict writing test. But to be honest, when talking with a native English speaker, you do not need to worry too much about the difference. Sometimes native speakers use each other to refer to three or more. What is most important is that you understand the idea of reciprocal pronouns and how they act in a sentence. At the beginning of this report, you heard a few lines from the movie The Sixth Sense.
We don't see each other.
You will hear native English speakers use reciprocal pronouns in many other films, television shows, and news stories. Listen carefully to how native speakers use them. A piece of advice for you. When you use each other in speaking, pay careful attention to the ch sound at the end of each. It is a difficult sound for speakers of many languages. I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the election of Martin Van Buren as the 8th President of the United States. Van Buren had served as President Andrew Jackson's Secretary of State and later his Vice President. Jackson asked his political party, the Democrats, to nominate Van Buren as their presidential candidate in the 1836 election. The Whig Party was against him, but their opposition was divided. Van Buren won the election easily. Jackson stood beside Van Buren as the new president was sworn in at the Capitol building in Washington. Physically, the two men were very different. Jackson was tall, with long white hair that flowed back over his head. Jackson's health had been poor during the last few months he spent in the White House. He seemed tired. There was almost no color in his face. Van Buren was much shorter than Jackson and had much less hair. His eyes were brighter than those of the old man next to him. In his inaugural speech, Van Buren noted that he was the first American born after the Revolution to become President of the United States. He was also the first president who was not from a British family. His family was Dutch. Van Buren said he felt he belonged to a later age. He called for more unity among Democrats of the North and South. He said better times were ahead for the country. Martin Van Buren had a poor education as a boy. He went to school only for a few years. His father was a farmer and hotel keeper at a small town in New York State. Politicians, including Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, had sometimes visited the hotel. By listening to them and others, the future president learned about politics. Eventually, Van Buren studied in a law office and became a lawyer. In the first years of his career, he defended tenants and renters who were fighting large plantation owners for their land. As a result, he developed a reputation for helping the common man. Van Buren became a local official and then a senator and governor of New York. When he was 24, he married a young woman he had grown up with. But she died of tuberculosis after 12 years, leaving him with 4 sons.
And after that, he was known as quite charming among the ladies, as they said in those days.
Historian Joel Silby is an expert on Martin Van Buren. Mr. Silby says most people who knew Van Buren liked him. He seemed warm and friendly. He tried to keep his political life and his social life separate. It was not unusual to see him exchange handshakes, smiles, and jokes with men who were his political enemies. But he did not have a national reputation like Andrew Jackson had.
What he was known for and what got him into the vice presidency and then the presidency was that he was Jackson's right-hand man.
Van Buren had been president for just a few days when an economic crisis struck the country. The crisis had been building for months. It really began with the death of the Bank of the United States more than a year before. The bank had been so strong that it was able to control the economy throughout most of the country. It also helped control smaller state banks. It refused to accept the notes or paper money of these banks unless the state banks could exchange the paper for gold or silver money. President Jackson had opposed the Bank of the United States. He vetoed a bill that would have continued it. After the powerful bank closed, a number of new state banks opened. All of them produced large amounts of paper money, many times the amount they could exchange for gold or silver. Business speculators used much of this paper money to buy land from the government. These men bought the land, held it for a while, then sold it for more than they paid. The government soon found itself with millions of dollars of paper money of questionable value. To stop these activities, Jackson had ordered only gold or silver payments for government land. But many banks did not have enough gold to cover the paper notes. At the same time, American agriculture was having trouble. In 1835 and 1837, many crops failed. American traders had to import farm products from Europe, and they had to pay for them in gold or silver. In the spring of 1837, just as Martin Van Buren was taking office, the demand on banks for gold and silver grew too heavy. The banks stopped honoring their promises to exchange their paper money for gold. They said the suspension was just temporary, that it was necessary to stop for a while all payments in gold or silver. The crisis became worse. Many of the weaker state banks closed. Those that stayed open had almost no money to lend. Businessmen could not pay back money they owed the banks, and they could not get loans to keep their businesses open. Many factories closed. Great numbers of people were out of work, and prices rose higher and higher. Most people struggled to buy food and other necessities. The price of flour and meat doubled between 1835 and 1837. Even coal, the fuel people used to heat their homes, cost two times as much. Violence finally broke out at a protest meeting in New York City. Some in the crowd demanded action against the rich traders. About 1,000 people marched to a store, forced their way into it, and destroyed large amounts of flour and grain. Businessmen blamed the government for the economic depression. They said the biggest reason was a decision former President Jackson made. Jackson's order required the government to accept only gold or silver for government land. Opponents said the order had caused fear and mistrust. Even some of Jackson's strongest supporters said it should be lifted. They said the measure had done its job of ending land speculation. Now, they said, it was hurting the economy. Two of President Van Buren's closest advisors urged him to continue the order. Lifting it, they argued, would flood the federal government with worthless paper money. Van Buren was troubled. The federal government had already lost $9 million because of bank failures. The president wanted to make sure the government had enough money. and he wanted this money safe until needed. Yet he did not believe the federal government had the responsibility for ending the Depression. And historian Joel Silby says Van Buren did not believe the government had the right to interfere in any way with private business.
He said that over and over again, that the federal government doesn't have the power to do this.
Mr. Silby adds that Van Buren's political philosophy grew out of the beliefs of former President Thomas Jefferson. All of his life, Van Buren claimed to be a Jeffersonian Democrat.
That had very specific meaning to him. Limited government, freedom for people, meaning white males. He was an egalitarian within the limits of those years.
Van Buren also shared Jackson's suspicion of bankers. In general, he believed no group, neither the government nor the wealthy, should have too much power, not even to help the economy. So Van Buren decided to continue Jackson's order. No government land could be bought with paper money. The American economy got worse. The president called a special meeting of Congress. In a message to lawmakers, Van Buren said, "Overbanking and overtrading had caused the Depression." He proposed several steps to protect the government. One of them was for Congress to pass a law permitting the government to keep its own money in the Treasury. America's Treasury Department received money when it collected import taxes and sold land. It used this money to pay what the government owed. The Treasury did not, however, hold the money from the time it was collected to the time it was paid out. The Treasury put the money in private banks. President Van Buren wanted to end this custom. He wanted a law to let the Treasury keep government money in its own secure places. The Whigs criticized Van Buren for thinking only of protecting the federal government and not helping businessmen, farmers, and the states. Some Democrats, who believed strongly in states' rights, also opposed Van Buren's idea. All these opponents provided enough votes in Congress to defeat the proposal. Van Buren tried again the following year to get approval for an independent treasury. Again, the proposal was defeated. Finally, in June 1840, Congress passed a law enabling the Treasury Department to hold government money itself. Van Buren signed what was called the Independent Treasury Bill. But the economic depression continued. Martin Van Buren also faced an international challenge from a surprising place. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.